Well, hello and welcome to a mini Lit Bits. My name is Adam Smythe. I'm here with James Kidd, and it's a horrible evening in December.
A rainy night in Soho, as I think Pogues had it.
Exactly, and it is a rainy night in Soho. We're standing outside the French House pub on Dean Street. It's about 5 p.m. The pub is absolutely rammed with drunk, out-of-work actors and unpublished novelists.
And a magician who had an egg trick and an extraordinary way with coins.
He did. We stood at the bar and we had to move away after about 10 minutes of David Blaine action. But if we thought we might think a little bit about literature and walking, and maybe literature and Soho and walking. I suppose the French House is a good place to start because it is the literary haunt, isn't it, I think, of people. I think Dylan Thomas lost his manuscript of something or other here, and he used to play a game called Cats and Dogs.
What does that mean?
Where he would simply get on all fours and crawl around and bite women's ankles.
Really? Did he invent the same game?
I think he did. It's an amazing what you can get away with in the name of poetic genius.
That's true. And it's amazing that... And then around the corner we've got the Coach and Horses, where I think Patrick Hamilton used to hold court and made an appearance in the new, or the latest Ian McEwan novel. And I think it was one of those strange novels where you felt that Ian McEwan was about to walk on stage to be played by Ian McEwan in the movie. But a sort of sense of a kind of glorious, slightly seedy, drunken, but productive past.
Yeah.
Geoffrey Bernard writing his low-life column and losing limbs on a fairly regular basis.
And that past does sort of hang in the air with a particularly vivid way, and you sense these people in the French House who we can see through this frosty glass window. And it is rammed at 5 p.m. with drunk people. Like, still kind of enacting that model of literary behaviour, aren't they? It does seem to be still with us, that way of...
But are they enacting a model of literary behaviour that is getting drunk at 4 p.m. without necessarily writing the magnum opus? Or there was the wonderful Radio 4 programme recently about Julian McLaren Ross and the sort of slight disappointment of a man who perhaps liked the literary lifestyle a bit more than he liked the actual sitting down and scrawling bits of language onto other bits of paper.
Yeah, well, I know which is the more significant.
Absolutely.
Okay, should we take a little stroll? It is raining, so
you're
getting wet while you're listening to us on your headphones.
I'll put my umbrella up. Hang on.
James is...
So it's a live stunt umbrella. Oh, here we go.
$2.99.
It really is.
Okay, and so let's go under the umbrella, otherwise my little mic is going to get wet. And so we're leaving the French House, wandering up Dean Street, and it's passing, just reaching old Compton Street. And I suppose when one thinks of literature and walking...
Oh, Lord.
It's often striding across fields of sweeping corn or Hampstead Heath, and maybe we'll get out to Hampstead Heath one day and talk about it. But there's something particular about the kind of rammed city Soho walk, not least the kind of danger of getting run over as we move into Dean Street.
But it's quite exciting, I think. You do feel the press of other people, of other lives. And being goosed by Litbit hosts. And the sense of, you can see why this was so inspiring, that you could walk around the corner here into Butcher Street and quite possibly meet Howard Jacobson.
That would be...
Who I think actually does live down there.
He does live down there. And it's a funny thing when you're walking along, your relationship to the environment and to the street around you and the fabric, as architects say, of the city and other people, and whether as you walk you notice them and have a heightened sense of what you're passing and where you're seeing, or whether you kind of walk and fade out and the landscape becomes your sort of mental landscape that you sort of retreat within and don't actually notice what you're passing or who you're seeing.
That's right, and I think writers often see themselves as anonymous observers. So maybe the city, for that point of view, is tremendously helpful, that no one notices the fact that you're looking at them as they study your behaviour or are inspired by you falling out of Quo Vadis.
That's right. Well, the Crown that we're passing now on kind of Bateman Street. I suppose, is walking through a city like reading a book? I don't know. Is a city like a novel? One of the things I suppose is that when you're reading a book, everything in the world of the book is there on the page. And you could imagine that there's a life around the corner that isn't recorded, but that's only your imagining, so it's not really there in the book. But there is this fabulous sense, isn't there, as we walk to the top of Dean Street, past the Red Fort, whatever that is, of round that corner that we're not going to take on the left. There's a whole other world going on and a whole other load of probably podcasters wandering around with microphones.
Absolutely.
And umbrellas, and you know, we'll never quite see that, but it's reassuring that it's there.
Well, I think something which is becoming another ghost on the pod, Ulysses was obviously for Joyce a bit like writing the novel, recreating I think the day that he met his future wife. And beep if you love lit bits. And the way of creating the interaction of one imagination with all these others that are wandering about.
Well, let's go left down St Anne's Court. Court.
Oh, well, this is a glorious memory actually down here, which is one of the sad things about when I was a kid in St Anne's Court. There used to be a heavy metal shop where I indulged all my most angry feelings about being asked to do washing by my mother. So I listened to lots of songs about Satan. And it's one of the strange things about returning to a city over and over again is you realise all the things that disappear, because this is now no longer here, and I doubt anyone here would have any memory of it. And it's a strange thing, which is perhaps a little bit like a book, the things that get deleted to create the new sense of a place.
Yeah. And your journey down St Anne's Court here now has to be a unique one on some level, because those memories get reanimated and you can sort of see the heavy metal shop and the long-haired youth from Surrey with the shorts going in to buy the records.
Absolutely, and coming out smelling faintly of hemp, I remember. But I think now it's a locksmith's.
24-hour emergency service.
Which seems somehow completely inappropriate.
There was a curious moment in the early years of the 17th century when celebrity walks, sponsored walks, got kind of fashionable, almost Ian Botham-like occasions. Ben Jonson in 1618 walked to Scotland to meet William Drummond, and they've just very recently discovered, actually, an incredible manuscript describing it by his fellow walker. All these details are coming to light about the various travel taverns he stayed in. And Will Kemp, the clown, who features in Shakespeare in Love, was short of cash and Morris danced from London to Norwich. sort of Alan Partridge, Avon Lettre, and published a book called 9 Days Wonder, all about writing. And the other thing, actually, which I just remember now, is that pun that comes up a lot about feet, metrical feet,
yes,
and other people's feet. In Astrophel and Stella, Philip Sidney says something about other people's feet hindered his path or got in my way or whatever it is. And he's imagining kind of being tripped up in a literal sense, but also other people's writings and poems not helping his own attempt to talk about Stella and his love.
And this idea of the walking tour, I know that, I mean, in the Romantics, the idea of going, the Romantic age, the idea of going out to get experience because you were limited by what you could see often in and around London. So famously, Keats going to Scotland and through the Lake District. Wordsworth obviously spent enormous amounts of time getting away from Dorothy, banging on about how he hadn't done the washing. But I suppose again it returns to this idea of just walking places into the realm of experience, and a very sensual experience of that engages our hearing, our socks getting rapidly wet.
Yeah. If we attempted to render in prose or remember in prose this walk now, it would be extraordinarily difficult.
Incredibly difficult.
There's just an amazing amount of things happening at once, and we talked, I think, in another pod about the sound of pub chatter and the simultaneous, many conversations going on simultaneously, not being, it can be very hard to achieve in a novel, but it's similarly with walking, I think. It's just.
And what can we say about these lives of the people that are going past? There's a man in front of us, sort of getting rained on without an umbrella, man next to him in a leather sort of jerkin with a cigarette, but we can sort of see them and imagine some form of existence for them without knowing a single thing about them.
Yes, yes. And there's the odd moment of kind of eye contact with a stranger for whatever reason. And there's that momentary sense of a connection or a wandering or something. So and then they're kind of off.
If necessary, I'll get...
They're off into...
Are you finding, though, as we're walking and talking, that other senses have taken over? That is it? I'm sort of... I feel more aware of hearing things, oddly, partly because it's raining.
Totally. I'm incredibly aware of hearing. And first, because of the mic and the technicalities, but the noise of the car, definitely a heightened sense of hearing. I don't think I've looked at anything at all, really. And I haven't really clocked people walking past, someone going by with a red scarf and a red hat.
Immortalised.
On a
website now, forever, but
exactly.
Completely unaware of her imminent
exactly.
fame. And there's a nice circularity. I mean, there are those rather extraordinarily odd Paul Auster novels about people walking in these geometric patterns that, if mapped onto the universe, miraculously give you the birth date of Shakespeare. And I suppose there is a sort of pattern that's emerging that we're creating by walking, but I couldn't tell you what that pattern is.
No.
Beyond damp, increasingly damp sock, actually. It's becoming a trope of my observations.
That's interesting, the patterns that we make when we walk, because one thing about doing these recordings and these podcasts is that sometimes we leave the mic running afterwards or before, and you just happen to record a random but typical conversation. And you notice something about speech again, and something which is never caught in writing, I think, in novels and fiction, which is how non-linear it is, how it doesn't quite make sense, how so many ideas are started and then fall
That's
away.
Right.
And I'm sure if we look down at our walking paths from a kind of bird's eye view and track them, there would be this insane looping, kind of meandering, profitless series of stuttering arcs. That didn't really, and we could have got to where we wanted to go if we'd just gone through there in about a minute.
That's a very good point, though, isn't it? Because there's a narrative that's going on in my head that is partly listening to what you're saying, things that I'm thinking, and then the desire not to be hit by that man with his bag.
Yes.
But the sense of all these other narratives then happening past us, people staring with awe at us as we walk past, and foolishness as we're about to...
Gosh, that really is raining there.
It really is raining. This is real rain as well. Not the fake rain that we used in the previous podcast.
That's right. But it's the week before Christmas as well, isn't it? So.
And how are you feeling about Christmas? Is there any sort of literary component to the Smythe family Christmas?
Well, I haven't bought anyone any books this year. I was debating whether to ask for a book. There's a new biography of Thomas Wyatt that came out. It was written by someone who taught me as an undergraduate. And it kind of looks interesting, and I like Wyatt, and you vaguely knew this person, you know, 300 years ago. But it's 800 pages long.
Right.
And I just thought, I'm never going to, you know, it took me till I was 35 to get through Ulysses. So I'm just never going to read it, and it will just sit there. And I might look up a couple of references in the index half an hour before a lecture on Wyatt. But that's about as literary as it gets. The thing, everyone talks about Christmas in terms of panic and dread. And stress, and I don't really feel that, to be honest. I quite like it. I mean, I haven't done my shopping yet, but I'll just do it all tomorrow. And everyone having gloves as usual. I'm looking forward to it. How are you? How are you? How is the prospect for you? Do you have particular things you do each Christmas, like the same films and the same music? And I know you wear the same hat and sock.
And I have to deliver all those presents on Christmas Eve, and I know he's been naughty and. And who's been nice. Oh dear, oh dear, someone's just dropped their mobile phone.
Someone just dropped an iPhone in a puddle.
Yes, and actually this is the biggest tragedy. There's a crowd gathering around to look at this appalling event. Funny enough, I mean, it's a sort of unliterary Christmas. I see Christmas as a chance not to have to read any books, which is nice. But there is that extraordinary thing of re-watching Christmas films. I mean, I'd love to say that I've watched Citizen Kane as many times as I've seen Scrooge starring Bill Murray, and yet somehow I realised that in fact the films that I've seen most and analysed and know best are Miracle on 34th Street, or was it 43rd Street? Apparently I don't know it that well. But the feeling of security, of wanting to feel, I suppose, childlike in some way, and clearly to believe my father still is Santa Claus.
No, my father was.
Okay.
It's an odd bubble of time, isn't it? Where you lose track of which day it is, what time it is. You don't normally do the same things at the same time. You start drinking Buck's Fizz with your mother at 11 a.m. on a Tuesday, and that doesn't sort of feel odd. It's very weird. It's a bit like reading a book, I suppose, or getting absorbed in it in a world with its own temporality and conventions, which are slightly different from the normal ones.
And that sense of, I suppose, a chance to start again. It is why I think A Christmas Carol remains such a key text.
Okay, it really is extremely cold and wet now, so we are going to call it a day there. We're heading off down Tisbury Court. So if you never hear from us again, look for us there. And keep on listening, visit the website, tweet us, and we will be back soon with another slightly drier, more stationary version of the podcast. Goodbye.